talks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning and happy new year. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest today is Cynthia Moss, considered one of the world's foremost elephant experts. For more than 40 years, she's been studying the elephants of Amboseli National Park in Kenya. Moss and her research associates have identified and recorded more than 1,400 elephants belonging to 50 families over that time. She's deeply steeped in elephants in the wild, how they behave, communicate, interact, form societies, and more. Against the backdrop of the Ringling Brothers Circus and its elephants opening its Tampa engagement tonight, we'll discuss elephants with Cynthia Moss presently here on Talking Animals. Later in today's show, speaking of Ringling Brothers, we'll have a brief conversation with Diane Kuhn of Florida Voices for Animals about their plans to protest and educate at each show of Ringling's Tampa engagement. Also towards the end of today's show, in Name That Animal Tune, we'll be offering as the prize a copy of The Second Chance Dog, the latest book by our recent guest, John Katz. We'll get to all this later in the program. Right now, though, let's speak with Cynthia Moss about elephants with a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing us at dj@wmnf.org. Let's welcome Cynthia Moss to Talking Animals. Good morning, Cynthia.
Good morning. Well, it's afternoon for me.
That's right. It's a little after 5 p.m. because we are speaking to you from your tent in Kenya. So far, so good on our connection. That's a little hope that it stays that way. And so anyway, I'm, of course, eager to discuss some of your work over these 40 plus years and some of the elephant families you've known and studied during that time. But first, I'd kind of like to ask you to travel back pretty much all those years and maybe even a little beyond and describe what first enchanted you about elephants?
Well, I first came to East Africa as a tourist, and I was open to all the animals. And as most tourists are, I was fascinated with the big cats, the lions, leopards, and cheetahs. And I wasn't, you know, overly excited about elephants. They were just part of it. But then I volunteered on a project for 3 weeks in Tanzania, an elephant research project. And when I got to know elephants individually and understood their very complex society and their interactions and knowing them as you know, different, each a different animal with a different personality, then I got hooked on elephants.
So just in that 3 week project, the romance blossomed, basically.
Absolutely, it was somehow I knew that's what I wanted to do for the rest of my life, even after that 3 weeks.
Wow. So what was it about them, even in that just initial 3 week exposure, that spoke to you so powerfully? Were there just certain traits individually, or just the way the elephants seem to just live day to day? I mean, 3 weeks isn't a lot of time, but it sounds like it was like a transcendent experience within that time.
Yes. Well, I think the main thing was I was working with a biologist who had studied those animals for about three to four years, and he knew the histories of each of the animals. So it when you go out and you sit and watch a family of elephants, it isn't just what you're seeing right then in your head. If you have studied them or you know them, you have their histories and their what they've done and how many calves they've had and what their problems have been and losses and interactions and who the matriarch was 20 years ago and how she relates to those that are there. So it's the richness of mm-hmm. their lives and their history, because they're very long-lived animals with a very complex social structure. So once you know them, they become it becomes this like a family saga, like a, like reading a really good book.
Right. So it sounds like that was among the key differences between, as you first said, that like many folks that go over there initially drawn to the big cats and some of the other animals, the fact that the elephants had a story, a life story that you could be filled in on. And I assume this was Ian Douglas Hamilton at the time that you were?
Yes.
So after that 3 week connection was made, and it sounds like intensely, then you sort of really decided, hey, this, as you mentioned earlier, this is how I want to spend my life, and indeed that's what you've done. So, you know, now four plus decades later, in what ways do you feel differently about elephants? I mean, obviously that intense sort of kinship and fascination is there, or you wouldn't be doing it 40 years later. But I mean, are there ways that just from learning more about their family histories and spending that kind of time with them up close for all those years, that you feel differently about elephants in any notable way?
Well, I think I feel even more dedicated to trying to keep them on the planet with us. You know, things are really in a very serious state right now with the poaching for ivory, and their very future is in jeopardy, and that to me that almost takes over from the science, what trying to figure out ways to stop the ivory trade and stop the poaching becomes more and more important every year.
Sure. And maybe you could talk a little bit more about that, Cynthia, because it seems like the poaching, I mean, you've been there long enough to see, I think, a few cycles where it sort of dips and then it just rises, and then in recent time, I guess, kind of has really skyrocketed. Maybe you could just sort of place that in some sort of context in terms of the last few years, like what has really happened to the poaching and obviously the impact on the elephants, and what's driving that in particular in this most recent surge.
Yes, well, we had very, very bad poaching in the 70s and the 80s when we lost half of all of Africa's elephants by 1989, when an international ban was put in place, and that helped a great deal, and the poaching went down, and the price of ivory went down, the demand went down, because there were very good advocacy projects and awareness raising projects, and of which I participated quite a bit back in the late 80s. Mm-hmm. And that meant that people stopped wanting ivory. They realized it meant a dead elephant. And then in 2008, the Chinese were allowed to buy ivory by CITES, this Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species.
Yeah.
They were able to buy stockpiles. And that meant that the ivory trade and the ivory markets in China just blossomed with this bit of ivory that they got, which wasn't enough to fulfill any demand. And the demand grew, and there's a huge middle class now in China, and ivory's a very valuable and a wanted objects. And so the ivory demand is huge, and the price is very high, as much as $2,000 a kilo, you know, which is about 2 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
So we're in a, you know, having conquered the really serious poaching of the 70s and 80s, we're right back, if not in a worse state than we were before.
So it sounds like that relatively small adjustment in the CITES policy has had just monstrous implications, but do you also feel that there is a way to, as with those other instances in the 70s and 80s, to eventually contain this and then reduce this, or does this feel different this time?
Well, it does feel different because the biggest importers of ivory, worked ivory, were the U.S., Europe, and Japan, and it was easy enough to convince Europeans and Americans to stop buying ivory, and that, you know, that those campaigns really worked.
Mm-hmm.
And we really don't know how to approach the Chinese, although we're trying our best. But it's a very different culture, and it's difficult to try to get that message across. But we're eliciting the help of Chinese stars and, you know, and athletes, and it is starting to get across.
Okay.
It's a very hard, very, very upward.
Yeah, and it sounds like it's slow, and that this time, as in contrast to those other periods of particular high incidence of poaching, that it's just going to take longer to curtail this.
Yes, it is.
And let me, of course, want to bring this back in a way to Amboseli and some of your research. So what sort of perils are there for the elephants at Amboseli in terms of poaching? Is there less of that that goes on where you are?
We have had some poaching. In fact, we had virtually none until after 2008. So we could see the direct connection between that. And then we started getting quite a bit of poaching in 2009. But then we have a program of, not we, my organization, but I work with them, of community scouts. We have 300 community scouts. Those are the Maasai people who live around Amboseli. Mm. And they're unarmed, but they're well-trained and well-disciplined. And they have camps all around the park, and because our animals go in a much, much further than the park, and mm-hmm. they go out through the ecosystem. And these community scouts are just a model of how you can to do anti-poaching. I'm very proud of them and proud of the whole system. And that they are eyes and ears on the ground, and each of them has a relative, have, 10, 12 relatives probably who would phone them up. You know, everybody has cell phones out here now.
Okay.
Who phone them, saw something, found a dead elephant or found people that, with guns or something. So it actually works. We had an elephant killed in November, but a man was caught right away. Within 24 hours. So that was a very good lesson.
And probably the product of these community scouts. It sounds like it's a network that's very effective and moves quickly thanks to cell phone technology.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
It is. So these elephants are doing well at the moment. But, determined people could still come in. When something's that valuable,
right,
people will lose their lives for it. So we're not... we don't feel any, that it's definitely solved.
Right. It's just improved.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, let folks know this is Talking Animals. If you just tuned in, my guest is Cynthia Moss, who's been studying elephants and elephant families in Kenya's Amboseli National Park for more than 40 years. If you'd like to ask Cynthia a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663 or email dj@wmnf.org. So the Amboseli Elephant Research Project has yielded all sorts of important pioneering findings about elephants. Among them, including how elephant animals families form and function and intersect with other families. Can you sort of talk a little bit about that?
Sure. We have 53 families, and spread out through the population, and elephants live in a multi-tiered social system. If you think of circles of relationships, and the inner circle would be maybe a mother and her calves, and then the next circle that encompasses her would be her family, which might consist of maybe 15 to 20 animals and adult females and their calves. And then each family usually has another family, one or two other families that they have a special relationship with, and we call them a bond group, and mm-hmm. that's the third circle out. And then those three circles live within a clan area, and so they have members of their clan. And then we have the population basically divides in two, eastern and western. And so that's the next circle out. And then the final circle is the whole population plus all the adult males. Now, males become independent of their families at about 14 years old and move with other males or on their own or with families. But they never go back to their own family for any amount of time. So all those circles are the way an individual interacts with other members of this population depends on where that other member is in their circle, that circle of the social circle. And some are near strangers, some are, you know, close relatives, some are friends, and they actually interact in depending on what that relationship is.
Wow. So it really, it's very intricate and sounds like very prescribed, like who fits where. So given how sort of matriarchal elephant families and societies are, what happens when one family connects with another or as part of a bond group or even a clan? I mean, who's in charge? Because then you have, presumably you have multiple matriarchs kind of all together at that point.
Yes, in the wet season, or just after the wet season, which is actually what we're experiencing right now, the elephants get into these big aggregations. I've been out every day this week with them, and they've been in groups of 300 and more. Wow. Which is a wonderful sight. And in those cases, they look to the oldest female. Age is extremely important. The older the female, the more respect, and she's more of a leader. And they follow her direction.
I see. Okay, so there's not then when there's a group of 300 or more, there wouldn't be sort of a matriarchal power struggle, because even if there's two or three or however many matriarchs there are, the oldest matriarch, that's who's deferred to.
Yes, although it's not so much deferred. It's really, elephants are very cooperative rather than competitive.
Okay.
So they're not. I have seen some competition between families, but it's more in the dry season when there's limited resources. If there's enough grass and food out there, they actually appear to, obviously they want to be together, or they wouldn't get into these big groups of 300.
Sure, and they work well together.
Lots of things going on. I always think of it as a big county fair, of the old style county fair, where all they all get together, and the children play, you know, the calves play, the females reestablish bonds, and the young males spar and test each other's strength, and then the big males come in to find females to mate with. So it's all going on in these big groups.
What a great image of the county fair with all these elephants and the way they interact. Let's take one call, at least at the moment. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Cynthia Moss.
Yes, good morning. My name is Peter out in West St. Petersburg. Cynthia, I would just like to express my admiration for you and the work that you're doing to study elephants and bring what you're learning to the general public. I have always loved elephants. They oftentimes appear in my dreams. And I think that, you know, human society, in the older times and even in current indigenous societies, oftentimes it's a matriarchal society. And I think that's kind of where we as humans kind of went wrong, is when we started denying the sacred feminine. And I don't want to go off on a vector, but I just want to express my admiration for you and what you're doing. And, you know, here in Florida, we've got manatees. And from what I understand, manatees' closest relative are elephants. And having swam with manatees on many different occasions, I have sensed a deeper consciousness within them than,
Thank you very much for your call. Cynthia, however you'd like to respond, that is fine.
Well, I'd just like to thank him for those kind words, and I'm very jealous that he got to swim with manatees.
Well, I'm sure there's probably many people that would be pretty envious of all the time you spent with elephants in all kinds of contexts now over the years. You know, and so back before our nice caller, you know, we were sort of talking about matriarchs and how they do work well together, even in large groups, and the county fair image that you had presented. But sort of speaking of matriarchs, if not sort of grand dames in a way, I'm fairly confident that many people listening have heard of Echo, the late great matriarch that you've written extensively about and has been spotlighted in documentary films, TV shows, etc. Maybe you could describe what, in the context of what we've already kind of heard from you and learned about, describe what made Echo special. Why did she stand out to you? But also, why did she stand out to the elephants that she sort of presided over, in a sense, or led for all those years?
Yeah, well, I chose her because she was, for the filming, so because she was a big old matriarch with who was distinctive looking with her beautiful crossed tusks. And her family was relatively easy to find. It was, but, you know, when I started the filming with the cameraman, I got to know Echo so well over 20 years.
Yeah.
And it was kind of interesting because I really keyed into things that I hadn't noticed before so much in doing the kind of work I was doing. But watching one family over all those years, I got to know the individuals so well. And you know, elephants do have different personalities. We've actually shown this in scientific papers. And Echo was a very calm, very tolerant, very sweet-natured, if you want to say, mm-hmm. elephant. But what I found about myself, which was kind of interesting, was my job, but especially in the first two films, was to put the cameraman in a place where he could get the best shots of behavior, and so I had to be constantly aware of what the elephants were going to do next. And without even realizing it, Echo became my matriarch, and I was realizing that very subtly I was keying into her little movements and everything so that I would know, oh, they're going to move that way, or they're going to have a greeting with that group over there, so that Martin could be ready to film it. So she became my matriarch as well.
Wow. So you really became in sync, or some sort of simpatico in a way, and in ways that you would, sounds like, just wouldn't have imagined, even though you had that great affinity for her by that point anyway.
Yes. Well, I was keying into all her little intention movements and all her little behaviors that would indicate what she was going to do next.
Yeah.
So that was what was happening.
And did she, it seems like from the films and in your writings about her, that she similarly had kind of a sort of singular, if not magical, kind of impact on the other elephants, that even as matriarchs go, there was something additionally special or distinctive about Echo.
I think so, although it's hard to say. There are a lot of wonderful matriarchs we've had over the years, but she was very special in her calmness and what appeared to be her self-containedness or something.
Yeah,
that's
interesting. Well, there are other topics I definitely want to explore with you, Cynthia, including elephant cognition and some other things that I think are really fascinating that you've focused on or found over the years. But I want to just peel off briefly for a moment onto another subject. And we discussed or exchanged emails about the Ringling Brothers Circus opens its Tampa engagement tonight. And I know you're not particularly inclined to discuss Ringling Brothers. And of course, what you've devoted your life's work to is studying African elephants, whereas Ringling and other circuses tend to use Asian elephants. But I'm wondering if you'd just take a moment and sort of at least contrast life for a captive elephant with that of life for an elephant living in the wild.
Well, it's almost incomparable,
yeah,
actually. Because, you know, elephants living in the wild, if they're living in a peaceful place like Amboseli, are living with their family, and these would be females, and most of the elephants in circuses are females. They would be living with their sisters and maybe their mother, maybe their grandmother, their offspring, and they would have a very rich, active social life. They'd be moving around the ecosystem, maybe moving 10, 15, 20 miles a day, just moving at, when they wanted at the bequest of their of the behest of their matriarch who makes the decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And an elephant in captivity lives in a very restricted place, with very little space. They are taken away from elephants they may have been with for a long time. They're moved around. This is both zoos and circuses. They're moved around. They're sold. They're transported. They have limited interactions with other elephants. They're in, at least maybe not so much in zoos, but as in circuses.
Mm-hmm.
And if they have a calf, the calf is taken away from them at about 2 years old, and that would be very, very hard for an elephant whose calves, if they're females, live with them for the rest of their lives, if they're males, until they're about 14 years old.
Yeah.
So it's just, there's really no comparison. It's
right.
It's just a totally different life for a captive elephant.
Yeah, so it sounds like from what you're saying, and obviously from a scientific research standpoint in this instance, that when people talk about sort of letting elephants be elephants when they're in the wild as opposed to captive, I mean, as you say, there really is no comparison to that life, and they're sort of foregoing virtually everything that does make them an elephant if they're in captivity.
Yes, I believe that's true.
And anything else that you just want to say about elephants who, in addition to just being in captivity of any kind, who perform or especially have to travel to perform?
Yes, I'm reluctant to talk about any specifics because my expertise is not
sure.
Captive elephants, but knowing what I do about wild elephants, I can say that life on the road can't be very a good life for an elephant, and being transported in trucks or trains from place to place. And
yeah.
Being chained most of the time. And, elephants are large, dangerous animals. So in order to make them do what you want them to do, you have to have them be afraid of you.
Yeah.
And the training of elephants, which I have seen, I've seen the training of Indian elephants in India, and it's brutal. It's what they have to do, and they admit it. The trainers, the mahouts, the people who own the elephants admit it. They have to break the elephant spirit, and then they're able to make it do what they want it to do. And that breaking of the spirit is all important because elephants can lash out and be, can be very, very dangerous. They kill
sure.
a lot of people.
Right. So that's the way that those folks then can only way they, I guess, they can feel safe as humans to be around elephants in those circumstances is having gained that control through those means. So
yes, if you want to make them do something. Now, in the zoo world, they initiated a much better system of what's called protected contact, where the keepers are never in the same compound as the elephants. They do everything through bars, and they do everything by positive feedback. So that has proved to be very successful if you have to have elephants in zoos.
Right, and as part of a protective contact, isn't it also within reason, at least, where the elephants kind of make choices or have some free will in what they do when? I mean, obviously they're trained to give blood and medication as needed, but there's a whole different approach if, like you say, if they have to be in captivity to begin with.
Yes, it's very, if you have to have them in captivity, that's the way to do it.
Sure. Again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Cynthia Moss, who's been studying the elephants living in Amboseli National Park in Kenya for more than 40 years. We were in the home stretch of our conversation, but we invite you to join that conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing dj@wmnf.org. So, Cynthia, among the many things I find fascinating about elephants that I know that you're more knowledgeable about than probably anybody is their cognition and just how they think, how they learn, how they recognize things, or even people. Or I mean, maybe you could talk a little bit about that and just what you've seen and been able to glean from that over these years.
Well, I've had some colleagues come and work with us out here, and the more recent was a woman named Karen McComb and a man named Graham Shannon, and they've done some fascinating cognition studies. And the way that they find out to a certain extent how elephants think is by playing back calls to them, sounds to them. They're elephant sounds, or in some cases like lion sounds. And in a way, by playing back these sounds on very good speakers that could do this, the low frequency and everything, they're asking the elephants questions, like, what does this actually mean anything to you? The most recent study they did, which we just did a paper on, was they did a comparison between elephants in South Africa who had been the result of calves that had been the result of culls, where all their family members had been killed, and then they just captured the calves and then eventually kind of dumped them into, reserves around South Africa. And these calves really had no teachers, and all sorts of things happened where they were killing other animals, but in some cases. But anyway, they played the calls of older females to these elephants, and then recorded what they did. And then in Amboseli, they did a control, and they played the calls of strangers, say elephants from South Africa. They played their calls, so they were complete strangers, because they do recognize the calls of at least 100 other elephants, the females do.
Wow.
And what they got, what the results were fascinating. The Amboseli elephants, when they were played strangers' calls, bunched up and came aggressively at where the speakers were hidden, or just bunched and looked nervous, and they all looked to the matriarch to see what her reaction would be. And in South Africa, when they played the calls of an Amboseli elephant who were complete strangers, they sometimes did nothing. they didn't react appropriately, as they didn't actually know what to do, and they didn't know that there might be some danger, or they sometimes reacted by running away, but they just didn't have anywhere near the acuity of the Amboseli elephants knowing what
was that chiefly, Cynthia, because they had been orphaned, and so they just didn't have any kind of early exposure, guidance, training, etc., to start to kind of assimilate what certain calls, or what sort of otherwise apparent, to the Amboseli elephants, evidence of danger or something else. I mean, how that would read, how that would sound.
They were like 2 and 3 years old, and they never had adults to watch. And then they also did some interesting things where they played lion calls. And they found that the older the female was, they did this in Amboseli, the older females could distinguish male lions from female lions. Now, male lions for an elephant would be more dangerous because they're, twice as big as a female lion.
Yeah.
And they also could tell how many lions there were. when they were roaring, whether they were just one lion or three lions, and which and they reacted appropriately to the when there were several, then they were more, then the matriarch became more nervous and got her family together and put the little calves in the middle of the group, and that was fascinating.
So it's really acute, because you're not only saying, hey, I can identify that there's a lion and maybe what size, but I can identify that there's multiple lions in a very specific way.
Yes.
Wow. Really fascinating. Yeah. Jeez.
Yeah.
So, Cynthia, we're just about reaching the end of our time. Let me just quickly ask, So how many people work with you on the Amboseli Elephant Research Project? And I gather from what you said earlier, it's probably seasonal to some extent, but generally, how many people are working with you?
About three or four at the moment.
Okay. And yeah. And then does that number expand in a different time of the year, or is that fairly typical?
Well, if outside colleagues come in, for instance, such as Karen and Pam, mm-hmm. who would come out for 6 weeks or 2 months or whatever. So changes.
And then how is the operation funded?
Individuals mostly, family foundations, individuals, you know, giving mostly almost all of it from U.S. funders.
Sure. So I would, if people were interested in finding out more about that or getting involved in any way or just learning more about your work, the website would be elephanttrust.org.
That's it. Yes.
Great. Great. Great.
Yes.
Well, Cynthia, thank you so much for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals, and happy New Year to you, and thank you for all your great work over all these years. There's so many other things I would have loved to chat about, but it was fascinating what we did get into, and I appreciate you making the time to join us today.
Okay, well, I enjoyed it too. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. All right. In just a few minutes, we'll speak with Diane Kuhn of Florida Voices for Animals and hear about the protests of the Ringling Brothers Circus they have planned this week before each show of Ringling's Tampa engagement. First, let's step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner. This is Kevin Nealon with a piece called Cows on the Roof on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
Most animals are smart, although, you know, I remember during the tsunami in Sri Lanka, I read about this. The animals, they have like a sixth sense. They knew it was coming, and they took off for the hills the day before it happened. They all survived. They didn't tell anybody else. They kept it a secret. Come on, just us. Come on, keep it quiet. Move it along. Let's go. But I have a whole newfound respect for animals now. I give them a lot more credit. In fact, now when I see a dog chasing a car, I will chase that car too. Oh, yeah. Animals are something. I rescued a couple of cats not long ago. Hey, do your cats throw up all night long? Is that what they do? Is that the M.O.? I mean, all night long, all I heard was, whoa! And I wake up in the morning, and there is puke everywhere. It's like living in a fraternity house or something, you know? It's just crazy. And you know what? Not even puke. They're hairballs. And I know that because I sifted through it with a little stick. Couple of berries, but mostly hair. Mostly hair. Yeah. And you got to get it off the carpet quick, otherwise it stains. You've got to make a decision. Either get them off or let them accumulate and become like a sticky shag carpet after a while. Animals are smart. That's all I'm going to say. I watch the Weather Channel. They always show the floods in the Midwest, right? And they show the cow up on the roof, you know, surrounded by water. I don't know how she gets up there. I guess she comes up the stairs, I guess. Do they have stairs in a barn? I don't know. I don't know. She comes up the stairs, crawls out the window, grapples up to the roof, just waits it out. They should show that. They should show that. Maybe they should have the Cow Network. I'd watch the Cow Network. But even here in California, you know, the animals warn you before an earthquake. They'll start barking like crazy. The dogs, you know, the cats will hide under the cars. You just have to know the signals, what to look for. Okay, like if you live in the Midwest, right, and you're going down the stairs and there's a cow coming up the other way, you get the boots. You get the boots. It's common sense.
All right, that was Kevin Nealon with a piece called Cows on the Roof, taken from his album, Now Hear Me Out. All right, to tell us a little bit about Florida Voices for Animals' plans to protest the Ringling Circus during this week's engagement and also educate ticket holders about the circus, let's welcome the organization's Vice President, Diane Kuhn, to Talking Animals. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning, Duncan.
Thanks for joining us on New Year's Day, New Year's morning, no less.
You're welcome.
We appreciate that. So we've had various folks from Florida Voices for Animals on the show over the years, of course, but still maybe just be helpful just to give us a quick description of the organization and sort of what it aims to do.
Sure. Well, Florida Voices is a nonprofit. We're locally based here in the Tampa Bay area, and we are an animal rights organization. It was founded in the late 80s. And our primary focus is to just raise awareness about animal cruelty issues and then to let the public know what they can do to help the animals. we basically target all sorts of animal issues, from vivisection to exploitation to animals in entertainment to domestic abuse and neglect, factory farming, wildlife issues, and we also we promote a plant-based diet to help the animals.
Wow. All right. Well, that's an ambitious agenda. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So let's talk more specifically now about why Florida Voices for Animals is staging these protests of the Ringling shows and what the protests really kind of seek to do. And what I've tried to mention a few times today is that they're not strictly protests as much as protests, yes, but also as part of that, attempts to educate people who are on their way into the arena about sort of what goes on with Ringling and specific to the animals. So maybe you could sort of fill us in more about that.
That's really what we're all about, is education. We feel that a lot of people that do go to the circus really don't understand what's going on behind the scenes. Animals in circuses basically, as you know, you touched upon, live miserable lives, and it's full of deprivation, confinement, abuse. And Ringling Brothers, unfortunately, have a animal care history that is riddled with USDA violations and penalties. And their trainers have actually been videotaped over the years with numerous exposés that have revealed, the physical and psychological abuse that these elephants and tigers go under. And it's all to perform just these little cheap tricks, you know. Then they're beaten and they're subjected to, you know, all sorts of intimidation. So what we want to do is when they're these people, the circus goers, are attending the circus, we just want them to realize that what's going on behind the scenes. So we try to educate them. And basically that's why we protest, just to try to get it out there.
And let's say, this just popped into my head, always dangerous ground, but so let's say somebody's listening and they have tickets for tonight's show, Ringling Brothers. Just to sort of, I guess, as devil advocates, let me ask you then, as that person, you know, where could they find online, for example, something to support what you've said about abuse,
the training
or other things? I mean, you know, if someone said, oh, geez, you know, but this could just be somebody saying something, I don't have anything to back that up. Where might they go?
Well, there is actually a website called circuses.com where there is the footage that I'm talking about, where people could actually look at that. And really, you could just go anti-Ringling, probably even on the internet, and you could find lots of support for that.
Yeah.
We are actually going to have, like, we call it a body TV tonight, where we'll actually have a video where we will be showing videos at the demonstration of some of these abuses that we're talking about.
And this is presumably sort of undercover video of what goes on in those training sessions and just in traveling around from show to show, what's involved in leading them on and off the trains or to and from the arenas, et cetera.
So these
are more than protests. There's information that obviously then you have printed material or something that you provide to people. I guess it's probably too much to hope for that someone who's arrived there with tickets in hand is necessarily going to turn around and walk away. But I guess the hope is that with what they've seen and learned, that they won't necessarily go the next time where they otherwise might have, and instead go to one of the now countless circuses that don't have animals.
Yes, I guess we're just trying to plant some seeds, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And if they can, see us out there, question maybe what they're doing, and hopefully next year they'll think about it, or they'll talk about it with their friends, and they'll say, you know, there were those people out there educating us, telling us about it, and we're not going to go next year, kind of thing.
Yeah, so that's the thing. So it's not, no one's really, feels bothered or harassed or whatever if they show up tonight or one of the other days of the circus, which, by the way, I guess pretty much every show of the Tampa engagement, you guys will be sort of providing the same sort of information opportunity. Right, so there's tonight, there's tomorrow. I guess these go on from like 6 p.m. to 7:30. It looks like every day except Sunday, where there's a matinee show. And there, in that case, then I guess you'll be outside. This is Tampa Bay Times Arena. Trying to make sure I had the name change correct. And on Sunday, it'd be 3:30 to 5. So on the other hand, if someone's listening who says, "Hey, you know, I do know that, and I actually would sort of like to help in that effort," are you guys open to having others join the effort to sort of protest and educate?
Oh, absolutely.
And how would they find out more, or how would they do so?
One thing, you can just show up, that's for sure. But
okay.
We have a website, floridavoicesforanimals.org, and mm-hmm. we have a calendar of events on that. And they can just click on that, and they'll see exactly what's going on with these particular protests. Also, we have a Facebook page, Florida Voices for Animals. They can check on that. It's all the event page. We have everything on there. Our meetup, we have a meetup.com, Florida Voices for Animals. All the information is on there.
Wow. One way or another, you can get the information, pretty readily.
Mm-hmm.
Well, great, Diane. Well, you know, it's been a while since I've done one, but, you know, I have to say that there was even one instance where I was at one where, you know, when it was explained again, calmly, no one's like, bothered, or there's nothing shrill or usually just very sort of matter of fact with the information. But I have seen some people kind of turn tail and say, you know what, we already bought the tickets, but we just can't do it.
Yeah.
So even if it's not that immediate and great an outcome, like you described, the idea about like, hey, maybe next year when the circus is in town, you know, you'll do something else, or you'll just find a different circus that doesn't involve animals at all.
So. Exactly. That's what we hope for.
Great. All right, Dan. Well, thanks so much for those efforts, and thanks for being on the radio early on New Year's Day with me on Talking Animals. I appreciate it. Thanks
Thank
for everything.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely.
We hope to have a really huge turnout this year.
Okay, great. All right. Well, thank you again.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. I'm Duncan Strauss. Towards the end of the show, we'll play Name That Animal Tune, a copy of John Katz's new book, The Second Chance Dog, will be our prize today. We'll get to that in a moment or two here on Talk Animals. Right now, though, I want to quickly do a few animal news and announcement items, starting with Bill de Blasio, mayor-elect, and now I think officially mayor of New York City. One of the very first things on his agenda as mayor is to end the horse-drawn carriage industry in New York City. So that was part of his campaign promises, and sure enough, virtually day one, he announced that that's what was going to happen, and sounds like there's some idea to maybe employ those drivers in electric cars or some other capacity so they don't necessarily lose their jobs, but that the horses are no longer in those jobs. So hats off, Mayor Bill de Blasio. And more locally, officially, yesterday was technically your last chance to drop off animals at the Newport Richey Animal Control Facility. But they are closing, I believe, that facility. But there's still any animals that would be dropped off will still be available for adoption. And the remain there after the 31st will not be euthanized, they say, be cared for in the sort of normal way they had been and eligible for adoption. So wanted to quickly mention that. And let's see, also locally here before we run out of time, this month, starting today, now that we are indeed in January, the Humane Society, under the auspices of PetSmart Charities, has a deeply discounted, shall we say, availability of getting your male dog or cat fixed. Very, very reasonable price, but it's advisable to make an appointment. Just call 813-870-3304 or go to humanesocietytampa.org, but be sure to make an appointment. I think there's going to be very limited availability based on the reduced fees there. And I think that's probably what we'll cover for today. So we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. I'll be back next Wednesday with another edition. Hope you'll join me then. Also, hope you'll visit our website, talkinganimals.net, where we make available all sorts of information, as well as archives and podcasts of past Talking Animals programs. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. Please like us on Facebook, the show, and or me personally, and follow us on Twitter there. That's all found at talkinganimals.net. A huge, huge thank you to Maria Oliver for production assistance early this morning, New Year's Eve day, no less. So thank you kindly. That enabled us to speak with Cynthia Moss in Kenya from inside her tent. How about that, folks? I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Happy New Year's to you and yours. Have a good week. And a good year, for that matter. Be kind to animals, be kind to others, be kind to yourself. We're closing out today's show with an animal song. One more elephant tune. Oh, wow, I never did name that animal tune. Let's quickly do that. Jeez, jeez, jeez. So, if you can identify this tune, we'll probably take it off the air, obviously. You'll get a copy of John Katz's new book, The Second Chance Dog. First person who calls on 813-239-9663 correctly identifies this pretty relevant animal song. It's Talking Animals. All right, like I say, we'll take any guesses off the air, and we'll move back into telling you about our closing elephant tune. This is Tame Impala with Elephant on WMNF, Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, WeekyWatchy, and beyond. Thanks for listening. See you again next Wednesday at 9 a.m. on Talking Animals. Thanks. We'll be right back.